service, the world's radio station.
BBC World Service. This is James Menendez with Newsan.
Coming up, the fight against Islamic State. The U.S.
Several Arab countries have offered to carry out airstrikes against extremist groups.
We have countries in this region,
outside of this region,
all of whom are prepared to engage in military assistance and actual strikes for primary political fires.
Also today, results from Sweden's election. Why some cheerleaders in the U.S. are suing their team. And the story of the desperate struggle to get out of Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War.
He was hovering above the deck of the Wallace's crew, and he started throwing his family members out of the helicopter onto a moving ship.
That's our bulletin of the latest world news.
BBC News with Stuart McIntosh. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says several Arab countries have offered to take part in airstrikes against Islamic State militants, but any such action would be subject to approval from the Iraqi government. Mr. Kerry said he was extremely encouraged by promises he received of military assistance against Islamic State.
We have countries in this region, countries outside of this region, in addition to the United States, all of whom are prepared to engage in military assistance and actual strikes, if that is what it requires. And we also have a growing number of people who are prepared to do all the other things. People should not think about this this effort just in terms of strikes. That alone is not going to resolve this challenge.
Britain says it'll do whatever is necessary to destroy the Islamic State jihadists who murdered the British hostage David Haines. Prime Minister David Cameron said they were not Muslims, but monsters who must be hunted down and brought to justice.
We have to confront this menace. We must drive back, dismantle, and ultimately destroy ISIL and what it stands for. Because this organization poses a massive threat to the entire Middle East.
Queen Elizabeth has made her first public comments on the Scottish referendum on independence from the United Kingdom. She said she hoped people would think very carefully about the future when they cast their ballots on Thursday. Correspondents say the No campaign may be pleased with her remarks, but royal officials say it didn't breach her constitutional impartiality. The Queen was speaking to a member of the public outside the church at Drayton, near her Balmoral estate in Scotland. Pope Francis has presided over the marriage of 20 couples in the first such ceremony for 14 years. Among those married at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome were some whose situation would not traditionally have been tolerated by the Vatican. Several were already living together, and one bride had a child from a previous relationship. People in Sweden have voted in general elections that could leave a far-right anti-immigration party holding the balance of power. Lars Bevanger reports from Stockholm.
A win for the Social Democrats and the coalition of parties on the left would be a return to form for Sweden. The country has had a Social Democrat Prime Minister for 16 of the past 80 years. The Conservative-led government of Fredrik Reinfeldt has spent the past 8 years introducing tax cuts, which the left says it wants to roll back in order to spend more on welfare. The new government would not enjoy parliamentary majority, however, leaving them dependent on the far-right anti-immigration Sweden Democrats, who according to exit polls gained more than 10% of the total vote.
You're listening to the latest world news coming to you from the BBC. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has strongly condemned increasing anti-Semitism in her country. She was speaking at a rally in Berlin attended by several thousand people. Ms. Merkel said violence against Jews in Germany was an attack on the whole society and would not be tolerated. The rally comes after a sharp rise in verbal attacks on Jews following the recent conflict in Gaza. About 500,000 children in Gaza have returned to school after the devastating 60-day conflict between Israel and Palestinian militants. The start of the school year has been delayed for more than 2 weeks. More than 200 schools were damaged and another destroyed. Many school sites run by the United Nations are still being used as shelters for those displaced by the fighting. Police in Uganda say they seized suicide vests and recovered substantial amounts of explosives during raids on suspected Al-Shabaab militants on Saturday. About 30 people were arrested. Police believe they were planning to carry out imminent attacks in the capital of Kampala. Uganda has been on high alert since the killing of Al-Shabaab's leader earlier this month. A bizarre battle has broken out between two South Korean manufacturing giants over damaged washing machines at a trade show in Germany. Samsung says that two LG executives were spotted deliberately damaging the doors of Samsung washing machines. LG replied defiantly that the damage wasn't deliberate, but the Samsung product was rather weak. The German police were called, and LG agreed to pay for damage to four machines, though its executives had only damaged two of them. Prosecutors in South Korea, where both companies are based, are now investigating further. In the past, LG and Samsung have confronted each other over smartphones, televisions, fridges, and air conditioners. Washing machines are a new front in the global battle.
And that's the BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. Hello, this is News Hour with James Fernandez. Coming up a little later in the programme, reaction to the murder of a British aid worker by Islamic State militants. Here's the British Prime Minister, David Cameron.
We will hunt down those responsible and bring them to justice, no matter how long it takes. David Haynes was an aid worker. He went into harm's way not to harm people, but to help his fellow human beings in the hour of their direst need, from the Balkans to the Middle East. His selflessness, his decency, his burning desire to help others, not today cost him his life.
We'll also hear from the family and discuss how the UK should now respond. That's after the news at 5:30. But first, some more details have emerged about America's efforts to build an international coalition against Islamic State. The US Secretary of State John Kerry spent all last week shuttling from one Middle Eastern capital to another, trying to drum up support for military action. But Mr. Kerry said America now has all the help it needs. Several of the 10 countries that have signed up have apparently offered to carry out airstrikes on IS targets in Iran. Now, this is what Mr. Kerry told CBS's Face the Nation.
We have countries in this region, countries outside of this region, in addition to the United States, all of whom are prepared to engage in military assistance, in actual strikes, if that is what it requires. And we also have a growing number of people who are prepared to do all the other things. People should not think about this effort just in terms of strikes. In fact, as some have pointed out, that alone is not going to resolve this challenge.
My correspondent Barbara Patasha has been traveling with John Kerry, his man's character, ahead of a meeting on Monday to sort out some of the details. So, do we know which Arab countries have offered to carry out airstrikes?
No, we haven't been told about any specific Arab countries. We were briefed by State Department officials who said that there were several who had offered to participate in airstrikes. If we look at precedent, the Saudi Arabians, for example, took part in the air campaign against Kuwait in 1991. We were also told that would have to be a decision very much made by the Iraqis, because this would be taking place within Iraqi airspace in targets on Iraqi land. And the Iraqis, although they have quite a close cooperation with the United States that's built up over the years of occupation and afterwards, they've never had that type of coordination with the Gulf Arab pact, and until recently, the ties have been very strained between them, given that the government of Iraq is dominated by Shiites, and the Gulf states felt that this had brought them too close to Iran. So there's this sort of tension between them. It's the question of whether the Iraqis would feel comfortable with such an arrangement.
Is there any reason why this wasn't disclosed earlier in John Kerry's talk? I mean, is it because this whole process of building the coalition is still a work in progress?
It's certainly a work in progress. What we have been told constantly is that this is quite a big effort. A lot of countries have offered to do things, and they've offered to do different things based on their capacities and what they want to do or don't want to do. And all of this is being assembled and collated, and military and intelligence officials are working out the details. And the sort of goal here is to reach a coherent plan that can be announced or presented at the UN General Assembly later this month.
Is it likely to be a sensitive issue in some of those Arab countries taking part in this? Is that going to be a problem for some of those governments?
Well, it would be Sunni governments attacking or bombing Sunni militants. That can be an issue, and I think that was partly the hesitancy of some of these countries to see Islamic State as a real threat initially, because although it has a very extremist ideology, it has appeal to certain constituencies within these Sunni countries. And it has announced the caliphate, an Islamic state. I think also Sunni governments would have some sensitivities about attacking a group that is saying it is an Islamic state, which again would appeal to certain constituencies. But what we understand, at least what we've been told, is that there seems to have been a consensus among the Arab governments that this is actually a real threat to them, because it's a cross-border movement and it's got expansionist ambitions, and so they have to act. And one of the a key part of the American strategy is they want this kind of Arab participation, so it doesn't look like it's just a Western campaign. It doesn't look like it's the Americans returning in an occupation way. But having said that, it would probably be autocratic Arab governments who would be supporting the Americans, and that may play just as badly on the ground as otherwise.
Well, at the moment, the air campaign has directed its targets in Iraq. So the United States has already said that it'll strike Islamic State bases in Syria if necessary. So how does the Syrian government feel about that, given that its forces are also fighting IS? Well, I'm not too happy. Well, Middle East Editor Jeremy Bowen is in Damascus at the moment, and he's been talking to Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Maqsad. First off, did the Syrian government leave IS alone out of convenience because they were fighting the other rebel groups rather than the regime?
I think this propaganda is absolutely another mistake by the Western powers to justify the presence of terrorist groups, which they supported at a certain time through their agents and agents.
President Obama has now enunciated a strategy against IS, including the forming of a coalition, and he says, if necessary, airstrikes, including on Syrian territory. What is your government's response to that?
I think this strategy lacks a lot of very important elements. But those who would like to fight terrorism cannot fight terrorism in Syria or in Iraq without coordinated action with both governments in Syria and Iraq, and without a broader international coalition that should take also on board Russia, China, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and all other countries. You cannot fight terrorism when you collaborate with those who created these terrorist groups, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and others.
So if there was an air operation by Western air forces, the Americans most likely, perhaps the British, perhaps the French, on Syrian territory, without coordinating with your side, what would you do?
This is an aggression. I mean, an aggression should be built after.
So what should the West do? They've got a real problem. They see the rise of IS as a threat to their country. How would you say then they should deal with it?
I think they should review their policy. They should correct their stand and go again to the Security Council to agree on a common policy on combating terrorism, and to use all the efforts by every country in the world to combat real terrorism, not regime change.
And should the regime here be part of that effort?
If they forget about the very important role that the government in Syria could play, this will be a very big mistake. And this will not be a battle against terrorism. This will be a battle for regime change.
There is Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Maqsad. Well, there's another key piece to the jigsaw, and that's Syria's neighbour, Turkey. Much of the 3 years of the Syrian civil war, Turkey's been the main entry point for rebel fighters and weapons. The government in Ankara wants to see President Assad go, but it said it won't take part in airstrikes. However, it is now trying to plug the holes in the border. Our correspondent Mark Lyon has been given extremely rare access to the Turkish military patrolling that border.
Their day begins with an oath. Turkish troops vowing to protect the integrity and honor of their country's borders. in the southern region of Hatay, Turkey's army is at the front line as the threat from Islamist militants just meters away in Syria. From their watchtowers, the troops see villages controlled by the al-Qaeda-linked al-Nusra Front. Opposing the Assad regime, Turkey stands accused of empowering jihadi groups like al-Nusra and Islamic State, allowing resources, fighters and weapons to flow into Syria for much of the war. But now it's clamping down. Lieutenant Colonel Unsar Askel controls the command post.
And the white folks can have to control with them. Because there is no legitimate authority on the other side, machine guns are here to support the coordinate people.
The troops are controlling the side of the hospital to the tower. People who appear to have been trying to cross the water into Turkey, so they've come inside the armored vehicle, and we're off to see what's happening.
In the end, they're refugees. Some of the 3 million who fled Syria since the war began. The youngest here is just 2. Hosek Nayus tells me 22 members of her family left because the Assad regime bombed their village and killed their children. Not all of us made it, she says. One of her brothers died. Driving through the lush mountains, you realize the challenge of securing a 900-kilometer-long border. But until recently, Turkey was blamed for either turning a blind eye or actively encouraging the militants. They came here to stock up and receive medical treatment. Our foreigners flew into Hatay Airport to travel south and join Japan. All of that is now coming to an end, said Colonel Mehmet Ali Sina.
We captured 105 firefighters just this year. Just our regiment responds to this area. From different countries, Russia, Ukraine, division, Netherlands, they said they want to help Islamic jihadis. But it is not easy to report this problem anymore.
New radars and night vision cameras have been installed. As Islamic State has grown, Turkey has, it seems, ratcheted up to the threat. The change came after IS kidnapped 49 Turkish diplomats in Iraq in June, who are still being held. The fear of retaliation makes Turkey's next move delicate. Iraq and Syria are next door, but Lieutenant Colonel Umut Gormaz insists Turkey can protect Europe. Militants in
both. You are not sure if you are doing this. By proportion and weapons, Europe and Turkey must take part of those now. Islamic State will not be able to attack our borders. If they come, we will respond with all our might.
As we were driving away from the border wall, we suddenly saw a vehicle with Syrian fighters on board. We told they were members of the jihadi al-Nusra Front. We turned around in our attempt to come back, but we just left them. They've disappeared into the forest on the Syrian side. Opposition MP Mehmet Ali Edibogu says it's no coincidence that the jihadis are there and that Turkey is doing too little too late.
The Turkish government has great duty to care. Today, areas that are hit or are discharged only are very close to the Turkish border. Come to the sun and go there.
Simple methods are used too. A ditch is dug by the border to stop smuggling, and a wall has now been built at the most vulnerable area, but it's only 13 kilometers long. Turkey is finally taking action. A once porous border has been tightened, but the danger is close by, and relies on Turkey's ability to confront it.
That was Mark Lowen reporting from Turkey's border with Syria. I'm listening to news app for the BBC World Service. Still to come on the programme, Bobby Kennedy's daughter Rory on what governments now can learn from the Vietnam War.
One of the lessons that I learned is
that you will have to think through the consequence of war, of these types of engagements and entanglements that we're now on the brink of, and understand what the exit strategy is, what the goals are, and really think through our commitment to the people on the ground, forward, and to the consequences of those decisions for years to come.
Well, if you're coming up in half an hour. Our main news this hour, the U.S. has a number of Arab countries willing to take part in airstrikes against the extremist Islamic State group. And Queen Elizabeth has urged the people of Scotland to think very carefully before voting in so-called referendum on independence. Now, to outsiders at least, cheerleaders are as American as apple pie. These squads of impossibly toned women in short skirts, the classic color and perfect smiles, have been a fixture at American football games for decades. But behind the smiles, all is not well. Take the New York team, the Buffalo Bills. They're playing their first home game of the season today. It's the first time in half a century without their cheerleaders, the Buffalo Jills. Well, that's because a group of former girls are suing the team for not paying them properly. Other NFL teams are facing similar lawsuits. As we speak to Amanda Hess, who's written about this, extensively for Slate magazine. First thing Buffalo Bills case, what exactly are they missing?
Cheerleaders for Team Buffalo Bills are looking for what many cheerleaders of many other NFL teams are looking for, a prepaid minimum wage. They're looking to not be fined for minor infractions, like showing up late or forgetting to bring the right clothing. And they're looking for really a small amount of money back that they feel that they're supposed to drop from.
As you say, it is up to the minimum wage, and yet teams like the Buffalo Bills would make millions and millions of dollars, don't they?
That's true. Cheerleaders for the Raiders, which is an NFL team in Oakland, just settled with the team for, it's going to end up paying about $2,000 to $20,000 to each Raiders cheerleader, depending on how long she's been with the team. And the promise that in the future the Raiders will pay their cheerleaders minimum wage, which I suppose is a victory, but it's a very small one. It's a little hard to be happy that now the Raiders will be doing the bare minimum possible to treat their cheerleaders like workers.
So just give us this approach, to put it into context. I mean, how much would a typical cheerleader earn over a season? Just roughly.
Cheerleaders now are paid between $50 and $200 a game. They'll appear in 10 games over the course of a season. And so they'll make between less than $1,000 to a couple $1,000 for an entire season of work. And that includes not just cheerleader work, but also charity public appearances, corporate appearances, practices two or three times a week.
It's not just about money, and it's not that it is in the law, but I mean, in terms of the way they're treated, just tell us about the giggle test.
The giggle test is one of the rules that cheerleaders have to go through, sort of gauntlet, to prove that they are fine and pretty enough to be on the sidelines, and that involves jumping up and down and making sure that their sides are not losing. Cheerleaders also tend to have to do weekly weigh-ins, so if they come in over 5 pounds of their initial weight when they are additional, then they will be built and not paid for the game.
So as a modern woman, how do you feel about it?
Well, I'm of two minds about that. On the one hand, I think you can make the argument that cheerleading is inherently sexist. You don't see men running out onto the field wearing next to nothing, just happily supporting these men who are framed as the real heroes themselves, the players. But on the other hand, I think what the cheerleaders who are revolting against the system are showing is that this feminine work takes a lot of real work. It takes physical effort, it takes skill, it takes talent. And so I'm glad that they're highlighting this idea that this work of femininity actually is real work, and they should be compensated for it.
Just going back to the Buffalo Bills, I mean, is there a danger for these cheerleaders who do file lawsuits that actually the teams just say, fine, we'll do without you, and they're actually putting themselves up as well?
Yeah, I think you think that is a danger. But I don't think it's a danger that these women are facing every year. Unlike most jobs, these women have to audition every year. And every year, many of them are replaced by younger, faster cheerleaders. The NFL is show for decades and decades that they get some sort of benefit from putting the summit on the field. And I think the ethical thing now is to pay them for the service that they've given them.
That was Amanda Hess of Sport Magazine. Now, an extremely tug-of-war is threatening to derail plans to create America's first male fame. Archbishop Fulton Sheen became a household name in the 1950s through his television show. He's basically a Catholic pioneer of televangelism. So the long road to canonization has hit a major pothole in the form of a dispute over his body. It lies in the church of New York St. Patrick Cathedral. Well, to talk now on the extraordinary story gripping Catholic America.
On our program, the Right Reverend
Monsignor
Fulton
Gates
will deliver
a
scripture in his series of addresses generally entitled,
Right Your Life. Bigger than Saints, Notre Dame, Milton, Gaia, a Catholic archbishop, standing up there for an hour just talking to you about life and things.
Daisy Gibson, national correspondent for Religion Newsweek, describing the huge impact of the world's first evangelist in American culture. Following his death in 1979, work for the Beatified Sheen began almost immediately. His hometown bishop in Illinois took charge of the cause for sainthood more than a decade ago. But now, Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, the country's most powerful Catholic, has slammed on the brakes.
This whole story is rather medieval, with these battling bishops and fighting over the body of a would-be saint. But basically, the short story is this. Mega media star associated with New York, buried in St. Patrick's Cathedral, was born in Peoria, Illinois, in the Midwestern Divine Diocese. That's where he was ordained a priest. Peoria would like to lay claim to him. New York is saying, no, he's buried here, he's famous here, his body is here. This is where his main charge should be.
So if you don't know what to do, you've got a chin on him, and you make a deal with him.
The battling bishops share a joke in less troubled times with leaders of the Fulton Sheen Foundation. Bishop Gates of Illinois angrily went public with his frustration last week, saying that New York had promised several times to send him Sheen's body as part of the sainthood process. But Cardinal Dolan says Sheen's relatives don't want it moved.
In the early church, we had some very strong-minded leaders, even before, and they fought over a lot of things.
Well, that's Roger Delaney, one of the leading advocates for Sheen's canonization here in New York. Yes, he's made, but not derailed, by what's happened this week. Sheen's beatification was potentially just months away, but now it's stalled. And everyone needs to rise above the fray, he says.
The prayers, the good work, the education of people to the court, for God, is important. Dream, for me, this canonization will never die. I think what we need is someone who can work with the Pope's body, and that may be someone out of the Vatican.
Supporters of Sheen in Illinois are upset by what they see as New York's betrayal. In March, the drive towards sainthood took a major step when an official miracle was declared by the Vatican, a vital part of the canonization process. Midwesterner Bonnie Engstrom had a baby boy who was still born, but she prayed to her beloved Sheen, and after an hour, she started to breathe. She introduced him to me over Skype.
This is James Fulton. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I am Elsie Warner, Fulton Sheen, his former husband in New York City, and I think that's appropriate. But I also think it's appropriate for Peoria, you know, where he was born and raised in this area. I think it's very appropriate for us to have a significant relic and a shrine. If you want one too, a lot.
When tempers die down, there'll surely have to be a compromise. Bishop Jakey won't get all of Sheen's remains, and Cardinal Dolan has already said he's content with some relics, a lot of heresy maybe, being removed from the cathedral crypt below me here on Fifth Avenue. Bishop Sheen's cause has come a long way down, and while bishops come and go, saints remain forever.
Indeed they do. That was Manuel reporting there from New York. You're listening to News Out from the BBC World Service. Please stay with us. We've got a news summary coming up in just a moment. And then much more to come in the next half. The BBC World Service.
observe the headline.
The pregnancy is an escalation to ISIS have announced their emerging territory to be controlled in Iraq and Syria to establish an Islamic caliphate.
Right. You go further.
So yesterday there was ISIS in
tell me how it is.
The World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, says more than 1,900 people are now known to have died in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
Giving people a voice.
I'm trying to stay positive about all of the way of care when I saw my relatives dying in front of me,
looking for the future.
I think the reality is that NATO is not going to go to war with Russia over Ukraine.
BBC World Service.
I want the world to know this person is cured. This person no longer has the virus.
The World Radio Station.
Coming out after the beheading of a British aid worker by Islamic State, we'll discuss what Britain's options are now. We'll find the latest from Sweden's election, which is coming in from the past. Plus the lessons from Vietnam. A new documentary tells the extraordinary story of the final hours of the BBC. This is James Fernandez with you. So let's get a summary of the latest world news.
BBC News with Stuart McIntosh. US Secretary of State John Kerry says several Arab countries have offered to take part in airstrikes against Islamic State militants, but any such action would be subject to approval from the Iraqi government. Mr. Kerry said he's encouraged by promises he has received of military assistance against IS by nations inside and outside the Middle East. Britain says it will do whatever is necessary to destroy the Islamic State jihadists who murdered the British hostage David Hammond. The Prime Minister David Cameron said they were not Muslims, monsters. Queen Elizabeth has made her first public comment on the Scottish referendum on independence from the United Kingdom. She said she hopes people will think very carefully about the future when they cast their ballots on Thursday. Correspondents say that no campaign may be pleased with her remark, but royal officials. They didn't breach their constitutional impartiality. Pope Francis has presided over the marriage of 20 couples in the first such ceremony for 14 years. Among those married at St. Peter's Basilica were people whose situation would not traditionally have been tolerated by the Vatican, including several who were already living there. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has strongly condemned increasing anti-Semitism in her country. Speaking to a rally in Berlin attended by several thousand people, Mrs. Merkel said violence against Jews in Germany was an attack on the whole of society and was not to be tolerated. People in Sweden have voted in general elections what could leave a far-right anti-immigration party holding the balance of power. Exit polls suggest the coalition led by the centre-left Social Democrats is likely to oust the centre-right government. If the polls are confirmed, the coalition might have to depend on the votes of the Sweden Democrats, who oppose the country's generous immigration policy. They deny being racist, but no mainstream party wants to work with them. BBC News. We're listening to news out from the BBC. Now, America's efforts to mobilize its allies against the Islamic State was given a good deal of added momentum by the beheading of two American journalists. People in the United States were outraged. Well, the murder of a British aid worker by IS fighters may have a similar impact here in the UK. Late last night, following a grim pattern, a video appeared showing David Haynes kneeling in the desert and dressed in an orange robe. Next to him, a masked man had been brandishing a knife, while his captive, clearly under duress, blamed the British Prime Minister. What happened? Well, this was the response of David Cameron when he spoke at Downing Street earlier today.
We will hunt down those responsible and bring them to justice, no matter how long it takes. David Haynes was an aid worker. He went into harm's way not to harm people, but to help the fellow human beings in the hour of their direst need, from the Balkans to the Middle East. His family spoke of the joy he felt when he learned his daughter's job in Syria. His selflessness, his peacefulness, his burning desire to help others, has today cost him his life. But the whole country, like his grieving family, can be incredibly tired of what he did and what he stood for in his humanitarian mission. David Haynes was a British hero. The fact that an aid worker was taken, held and brutally murdered at the hands of ISIS, sums up what this organization stands for. They are killing and slaughtering thousands of people, Muslims, Christians, minorities across Iraq and Syria.
They boast of their brutality. They claim to do this in the name of Islam. That is not. Islam is a religion of peace. They are not Muslims, they are monsters. They make no secret of their desire to do as much harm, not just in the Middle East, but to any countries or people who seek to stand in their way or dare to stand for values that they disagree with. It was an ISIL fanatic who gunned down four people in the Middle East. So let me be clear. The British people need to know that this is a fanatical organization called ISIL that has not only murdered a British hostage, they have planned and continue to plan attacks across Europe and in our country. We are a peaceful people. We do not seek out confrontation, but we need to understand. We cannot ignore this threat to our security and that of our allies. There is no option of keeping our heads down that would make us safe. The problem would merely get worse, and it has done for the recent months, not just for us, but for Europe and for the world. We cannot just walk on by if we are to keep this country safe. We have to confront this menace.
David Cameron. Well, David Haynes' family haven't given any interviews about what happened, but his brother Mike ran out this statement on their behalf.
As you're aware, our brother, son, father, nephew, husband, and friend, recently and cold-bloodedly murdered by ISIS, have been held hostage since March 2013. We can only pray and give our thanks to the agency that has helped us during the time of need. We agree with the government in that ISIL are extremely dangerous and pose a threat to every nation, every religion, every politics, every person. Radicalization remains the biggest threat to the whole human safety of every person in the world. It is not a race, religion, or political issue. It is a human issue and it is in our everyday lives. In every case, it's not to blame for ISIL, nor is it to blame for these people of Middle Eastern descent. The actions are completely opposed. Terror as an instrument of population control is the highest of fear many disenfranchised throughout society. As you can see, there are a strong national, not just British, who have fighting for peace. We need, as a society, to look at how we do this problem.
He was captured in Syria just days after he started work in the country. He was there for a charity called ACTIS, the Agency for Technical Cooperation and Development, where it was based in Paris. Frederic Rousseau, the co-founder.
It was a peaceful meeting with the Netherlands, all the things
I could say much more. In the video, the IS fighter threatened to kill another British hostage. And that fighter is himself British, judging by his accent. Imam Tariq Asim is head of the biggest market news in Northern England, called a practicing lawyer. Ernest Paul Neville Jones is a former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee that oversees the work of the intelligence agencies here in the UK. How does she think Britain should react?
I think it is right and necessary now to increase the level of military assistance to those on the ground who are fighting ISIL. I think the worst thing that might happen is on the ground and the threat that they represent, both military and ideological. So we need to build a political base. And we need to, I think, move towards a sustainable military strategy.
But equally, I'm getting the sense that we wouldn't want to see any knee-jerk response to what has happened overnight, however abhorrent we might think it is.
Absolutely. I mean, our thoughts obviously are with Mr. Haynes' family. I mean, this is the most abhorrent action. And we're all united in that. And I think irrespective of creed or belief, I would hope that it's going to be possible to do something to locate and to be able to rescue the hostages. But I think that is very difficult. It is one part of policy. But I think the main driver has to be how you now get at the root of actually ending this threat and the civilized society in the future.
Imam Khari, I've seen, should what happened to David Payne, should it influence UK's policy abroad system?
Essentially, we absolutely condemn what happened and our thoughts and prayers are with the family of the victim. I think I applaud it to be that we shouldn't have a military reaction. We need to build very strong, robust political as well as military strategy, and that should involve the regional players, the Arab world, as well as Iran and Russia as well. Otherwise, we can end up in a situation where we have a military campaign and after that, with no legacy, and perhaps what we're going through now is a result of that kind of strategy being adopted over 10 years ago when we went to Iraq.
Is there a danger, though, of doing what the militants of Islamic State want? In other words, to draw Western countries into a much wider conflict?
And as a result, I think we need to have a very robust and dynamic strategy. But at the same time, we can't ignore them. They are running this terror campaign and terrorizing the people in the Middle East, irrespective of their faith. Muslims are being killed, Christians, Yazidis. They're killing humanitarian aid workers who've gone out of their comfort zone to help people in the East. And these terrorists cannot see the difference between someone who's gone out there to help people who've been displaced. An attack on David Hume seems like an attack on the whole humanitarian network, the humanitarian corps.
And that makes it unique. Bernard Sabadell, how are we falling into a trap and doing exactly what the militants want and getting involved into a conflict that is actually much more local than international?
No, I mean, it has local dimensions, certainly. And it very much destabilizes the state of Iraq. But it has much, much wider international implications. And these will grow in the absence of action being taken against it. Clearly, we are being committed to our being simulation of intimidation and tension. We have to respond. But my point is, we respond in a way, in our own way, on our own timing, and in a way that is effective. And therefore, we have to build the means to do that, which are both political and military. But I'm quite clear that we cannot just ignore it.
There's no doubt in your mind that Islamic State is a threat.
I have no doubt at all that it's a threat to the community. This is obviously true to the people who it's lured into its activities and to our own policy and ideology and an attitude to life, which is totally unacceptable and which is very dangerous. Very, very few of them, I imagine, actually either wish to or succeed in coming back to this country and actually have harm. But you only need one. Iraq and Syria are much more accessible to control. Like Ram going to Afghanistan, you have much, much bigger numbers involved. And this is in a sense a massive activity, whereas hitherto, I think it was fair to say that in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the numbers were still quite substantial, but looking like the potential numbers involved now.
And Kakari, I've seen, the point about this is that the militants in this video, as in previous ones, speak in an English accent, and of course that has raised fears about people going out to Iraq and Syria and becoming radicalized. Have efforts to stop the flow of young Muslims going on to have simply failed.
British Muslims and imams are very clear and have been bringing out this message that people from Britain should not get involved in the geopolitical conflict that's taking place in Syria and Iraq.
But is that some of them or all of them?
All of them, of course, the mosque and the institutions are all doing that. We also want to have hate speech and to incite hatred, working underground or on the internet.
and it has in literally great time by running a very sophisticated social media campaign where the charge is alluring, sweet, romanticized, idealized. It's a hell state that he's running. And we need to step up the work in order to prevent any remote-sexual individuals falling prey to their ideology.
And the intelligence agencies, thereby, is not a joint contract.
Moving ship that was going 6 or 7 knots.
through the ocean and into, luckily, the hands of the personnel on the USS Kirk, who caught each and every one of these children, including his wife and other family members. Of course, then he was the pilot in the predicament because he still had this Chinook and no place to land and running out of gas. And so he took the Chinook about 50 yards off of the starboard side of the ship. He leaned the helicopter over to the right, and he jumped off the left side of the helicopter. And the helicopter goes down into the ocean, explodes.
Loud noise, shrapnel blowing up. Suddenly, it's quiet. He pops up, he's alive. The helicopter was only about 20 feet from him when he hit the water. It was amazing. It is absolutely extraordinary. And you know, riding Seth and I have watching it, it's just a growing panic in the way you face it, basically looking at that last day of the clock ticking. I mean, the symptoms are building and building.
You know, it's an inherently dramatic story, I have to say. And, you know, the clock is ticking, and they have 24 hours to get out of town, and there are about 6,000 Americans there, and many have important news.
Did you come to any conclusion to yourself about the end of the war and whether America, in the final analysis, betrayed South Vietnam?
Well, I think that you did betray South Vietnam. I think that, you know, we had a commitment to South Vietnam and to the people who we worked with, and, you know, we abandoned them. I think one of the lessons that I learned in making this film is that you really have to think through the consequence of a war, of these sort of engagements and entanglements that we're now on the brink of, and understand what the exit strategy is, what the goals are, and really think through our commitment to the people on the ground who are going to help deliver the consequences of those decisions for years to come.
For example, taking the situation in Iraq, you think that, as is so often the case, people haven't drawn the lessons from history, and actually it's been, you know, even the exact circumstances that people draw out of the same, you know, the basic lessons haven't been learned.
I think that's, yes, that's right. Unfortunately, I think there is a sense that we've repeated ourselves over the last many years, and that we haven't, you know, it's really amazing to me that this moment in our history here in America, the last days of the Vietnam War, is such a seminal event in our nation's history, and almost nobody knows what happened during those final days. And I've shown this film to historians, to older people, baby boomers who watch the television, and their best friends, their family members in the war. Almost nobody knows what happened. And, you know, I think we really owe it to not only ourselves, but to people around the world to have an understanding and appreciation of what happens at the end of the war, especially the ones who don't win.
Was there any sort of family pull for you? I mean, given that you're saying you're like, rather body came up and did 7 years before to try to draw up a plan for ending the war. I mean, was there sort of any feeling for you of sort of unfinished business at all, or as you say, continuing that understanding?
I don't think it was that, you know, a feeling of unfinished business. More, I think I just have always had perhaps a more acute appreciation of Vietnam because of, you know, my father really ran his last campaign because of his commitment to getting out of Vietnam. That's why he entered that race. And I think that I've just appreciated that war and all the lessons that it can teach us, mostly about what not to do.
And that was Rory Kennedy talking to me from New York about her new documentary, of course, Last Day in Vietnam. I just want to remind you that if you want to listen to these apps, maybe this edition, you missed some of those or previous editions, well, you can get a podcast of the program. If you type in BBC News Hour into a search engine, you'll see a list of the programs that come up and you can choose them. Or you can just subscribe to the podcast and it'll be downloaded twice a day. That, though, is it for this edition of the program. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for listening and until the next time, bye-bye.
Well, Craig will take them.